And welcome to Nerdstalker. I am Adolfo Fronda at Nerdstalker on Twitter with my buddy
Greg Vlory, aka Social Greg on Twitter for the Nerdstalker Media Network. Hey, man.
Big story. Me and Greg have been itching to talk about this one. So this one's from actually everyone, but in this particular story, it's BBC News. Let's say TikTok. Trump says he will ban Chinese video app in the U.S. So this was posted August 1. That's as of today's recording. President Donald Trump has announced he's banning the Chinese-owned video sharing app TikTok in the United States. He told reporters he could sign an executive order as early as Saturday. U.S. security officials have expressed concern about the app owned by Chinese firm ByteDance could be used to collect the personal data of Americans. TikTok has denied accusations that it is controlled by or shares data with the Chinese government. The fast-growing app has up to 80 million active monthly users in America, and the ban would be a major blow for ByteDance. As far as TikTok is concerned, we're banning them from the United States, says Mr. Trump aboard Air Force One. It was not immediately clear what authority Mr. Trump has to ban TikTok, how that ban would be enforced, and what legal challenges it would face. Microsoft has reportedly been in talks to buy the app from ByteDance, but Mr. Trump appeared to cast doubt that such a deal would be allowed to go through. If the deal went ahead, reports say it would involve ByteDance shedding TikTok's U.S. operations. A TikTok spokesperson declined to comment on Mr. Trump's mooted ban, but told U.S. media outlets the company was confident in the long-term success of TikTok in the United States. The move to ban TikTok comes at a time of heightened tensions between the Trump administration and the Chinese government over a number of issues, including trade disputes and Beijing's handling of the coronavirus outbreak.
They're not the only Chinese app that's out there that I know of. You know, and true. So you're right, as was stated in the article. How are they going to enforce it? Are they going to give me a ticket? Are they going to just turn off the server? I don't. You know, I'm trying to figure this all out. But
yeah,
but I know I use some Chinese apps that I'm not sure. You know, It's vetted by iOS, so I know that at least.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, who has been the gatekeepers lately? It's been like the app stores, right? I mean, you see Android banning apps all the time of these weird money type of apps or something like that that just don't behave nicely, as well as iOS. Apple has banned several apps, but for the government to come in and say we're going to do this, that means they would have to force the app stores themselves to ban these apps.
And you know, it goes back down to that control again, right? Right. What is interstate commerce, and how is the government going to regulate that? I mean, it goes back to that whole electronic frontier foundation stuff, right? I mean,
Like, I would imagine it would have to be some sort of national security thing, like excuse. Like, this is a national security concern.
I think that's the way they're going down, right?
Right.
Because I think going down the other way, it hasn't really been a way to really completely turn that off, right?
Because there have been companies that have banned TikTok from their employees from having TikTok on TikTok on their phones. But the one thing I see going back to the sort of the data point too is that they aren't the only app that's selling your personal data, right, to everywhere. And so it's not like the Chinese government can't get it by purchasing, you know, from third party sort of data vendors or something like that, you know.
Putting on the shoes of the Chinese government, they must be laughing their ass off right now. They're saying like, TikTok, really? Is that the best you guys could do? Really? Yeah.
That's like kicking someone out of the party after they've like drank all of your beer, ate all of the cake, hit the pinata open, have a bag full of candy. You know what I mean? And then going,
you have to leave now.
Yeah. You weren't invited. Oh, thanks. It's already tomorrow. Thanks. So yeah, so interesting. So another thing you said, right, was Microsoft was considering acquiring TikTok, and this put a halt on that. And then another thing I heard as well was that TikTok was shedding their Chinese ownership and trying to be an autonomous American company of sorts as well. Hopefully, I guess, to get this acquisition going and to stay in business, apparently.
This antitrust thing, you know, I had a couple sleepless nights because of some projects I was doing, and then I caught Jeff Bezos interview, and it was on CNET, and it was a big week for tech, I guess, just in terms of just getting everybody there on antitrust stuff. But amazing. Unfortunately, Jeff Bezos didn't have the answers. I don't know who's coaching him, but also I think the Congress were really coming after him. I mean, there was like questions like, so we have a report here from some employees that they could see almost anything that's, you know, PI, and they were even going down the road where like a competition, right? Mm-hmm. They were discussing like, so there's a report here by employees that even though AWS services your competition, you also are creating products that will, by learning about their business against their competition. What do you have to say about that? And, you know, he unfortunately said, you know, I can't stop any of my employees from, you know, he said something like that. It was like, oh my God, Jeff, did you really say that?
Right, right.
But you know, as you know, these dog and pony congressional hearings are just what it is. It's a dog and pony show that, you know, is really meant to probably look anybody look bad, you know, even Jeff Bezos, right?
So, yeah, it seems like it was more for like politics in terms of like election bids and campaigns and things like that. So those particular political individuals could be reelected, really, is what they're doing. And it seems like the Republicans were categorically against a certain side. They were pro, well, I don't know, pro. I mean, definitely Facebook seems to be in the Trump camp, and Google seems to be on the, you know, whatever Democratic camp that you, comes from the whole, depending on who wins, I think it's going to really, you know, determine the future business and who gets a, I don't know, more preferential treatment in the Oval Office.
It was very apparent where these kind of battle lines are getting drawn, especially when that Twitter thing came out, right? And, and how they handled throttling, right? You know, as we talked a few podcasts ago with Mark, really kind of taking a stance. Oh, you know, we shouldn't do any of the, you know, any of the filtering, you know, that's, this is a social network, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really fascinating. And then I'd like to see where Apple stands with all this. They're up, right? Or they have, they talked, I forget. I'm not the name of this broadcast. I don't know if they were, I think Tim Cook already kind of talked already. So there was a bunch of, you know, Apple, Google, Facebook, like you said, Amazon, right? So
yeah, there's a lot of interesting potential outcomes from this, though. If you look at the Microsoft pattern or blueprint, if you will, and a lot of what Scott Galloway has said as well, and a lot of people have been thinking, if you look at Amazon, I mean, they could spin off AWS and that could be a multi-billion dollar company, and then their own, you know, e-com business as well, and the other stuff that they're doing. You spin those things off, you have several different super strong companies, and then you look at Google and they can spin off YouTube, right? And that'd be a super powerful company in itself. So it's interesting to see how, you know, business can evolve from potentially breaking up these, let's call them oligopolies or whatever, if you will, monopolies to some extent, but, you know.
I mean, it's the 2020 version of antitrust that was going on in the turn of the century, right, with a lot of the railroad, you know, owners and stuff like that, right? So I think it's just interesting to see the evolution.
Look at Microsoft. You don't have to look that far back and look how it worked out for them. It worked out great for them being broken up, right?
I think so.
They got Office 365. I mean, you know, all kinds of stuff is happening for them. Azure, cloud, you know, I mean, you can go on and on.
I agree with you. The cynical side of me says that, like, wow, this is just a political football that's being kicked around, you know, and kicking some people around with them.
Thanks to Cron.com for this one. Data isn't just being collected from your phone, it's being used to score you. So this is Harvey Rosenfeld and Laura Antonini, the Washington Post. Also, thank you for this one. Operating in the shadows of online marketplace, specialized tech companies like you've likely never heard of are tapping vast troves of our personal data to generate secret, quote, surveillance scores, digital mugshots of millions of Americans that supposedly predict our future behavior. The firms sell their scoring services to major businesses across the U.S. economy. People with low scores can suffer harsh consequences. CoreLogic and TransUnion say that scores they peddle to landlords can predict whether a potential tenant will pay the rent on time, be able to, quote, absorb rent increases, or break a lease. Large employers use HireVue, a firm that generates an, quote, employability score about candidates by analyzing, quote, tens of thousands of factors, including a person's facial expressions and voice intonations. Other employers use Cornerstone Score, which considers where a job prospect lives and which web browser they use to judge how successful they will be on the job. Brand name talent purchase, quote, risk scores from Retail Equation to help make judgments about whether consumers commit fraud when they return goods for refunds. Players in the gig economy use outside firms such as Sift to score consumers, quote, overall trustworthiness. Wireless customers predicted to be less profitable are sometimes forced to endure longer customer service hold times. Auto insurers raise premiums based on scores. calculated using information from smartphone apps that track driving styles. Large analytics firms monitor whether we are likely to take our medication based on our propensity to refill our prescriptions. Pharmaceutical companies, healthcare providers, and insurance companies can use those scores to, among other things, quote, match the right patient investment level to the right patients. The surveillance scoring is the product of two trends. First is the rampant and mostly unregulated collection of every intimate detail about our lives, amassed by the nanosecond from smartphones to cars, toasters to toys. This fire hose of data, most of which we surrender voluntarily, includes our demographics, income, facial characteristics, the sound of our voice, our precise location, shopping history, medical conditions, genetic information, what we search for on the internet, the websites we visit, when we read an email, what apps we use and how long we use them, and how often we sleep, exercise, and the like. The second trend driving these scores is the arrival of technologies able to instantaneously crunch this data. Exponentially more powerful computers and high-speed communication systems such as 5G, which lead to the scoring algorithms that use AI, artificial intelligence, to rate all of us in some way. The result, automated decisions based on each customer's unique score that are, as a practical matter irreversible. That's because the entire process, the scores themselves, as well as the data upon which they are based, is concealed from us. It is mostly impossible to know when one has become the casualty of a score, let alone whether a score is inaccurate, outdated, or the product is biased or discriminatory code programmed by a faceless software engineer. That there is no appeal. What they're saying is that secret surveillance scoring places us in the precipice of the, quote, singularity, a dystopian turning point after which machines will make judgments about humans that will determine our fate. We either seize control of our future or risk losing it. And Washington has capitulated, really, to the tech industry, whose continuous loop of privacy violations, abject apologies, and payment of inconsequential penalties confirms that consumers cannot rely on the federal government for protection.
Oh my God, I better throw away my phone, I guess.
It's weird when you think about it, because at the end, you know, that whole dystopian future thing, and it sounds like science fiction, but it's here, and it's actually happening, and it's now. To our previous story, criticize China in terms of what they're doing, but we're kind of doing the exact same thing. We're just not, scoring individuals. We're just kind of glossing over it and calling it consumerism or corporate targeting or marketing.
Market research.
That goes to show you how valuable our data, personal data, really is, you know, and we just willingly give it up. And it's not just we're thinking we're giving up, we're going to get better targeted advertising, but really that's not the case. Oftentimes it's used against us, and it's feeding the bottom line of a lot of companies, let's say insurance companies in that example, right? Health insurance and stuff like that. So what they're doing is they're maximizing the extraction of money from our pockets, and perhaps even the service that we're getting gets limited based on that data that they receive. I mean, that's terrifying when it comes to your healthcare.
Thanks to Fast Company in the design side, co-design by Anna Lakchaki. Yeah, that was a really tough one. Why people should stop designing prosthetics that look realistic and start designing ones that work. So we're talking about design versus functionality. She's claiming there's this thing called expressive prosthesis that really need to kind of happen. So if you go down the article here, the idea is that transforming prostheses into accessories, expressive versions, can help users make positive statements about themselves. They may also be able to question notions of normalcy about the human body and help eliminate stigmatization. That's really the current landscape, right? But a recent research project, she wrote, explored the effects of a co-design approach between prosthetic makers and users in developing personalized covers. The project reported that amputees found involvement in the design process and a positive experience, and the benefits extended beyond expression of identity, supporting confidence and potentially to create a positive image of disability. But another study, as she wrote, looked into preferences toward prosthetic limbs with a realistic or non-realistic appearance. It found prostheses with a high level of human likeness were considered by non-users to be more attractive than those with a more mechanical experience. But the reverse was true for the prosthetic users themselves, who preferred prostheses that with a robotic designs, perhaps because of their greater functionality. So it goes back to this designing for functionality or designing for appearance, right?
Yeah.
And But culture, she points out, plays a major role where you have collective societies like Japan and Asia versus individualistic societies like UK and us, let's say. How are they viewed when we see an odd-looking prosthesis, you know? I mean, you see some of these runners in some of the Olympic Games, right? Disabled Olympic Games. You know, they have some really cool functional prostheses, right? You know, I think the point is that the co-design approach and maybe going towards this idea of really having users work with manufacturers to create the most functional design for themselves. I mean, let's put it this way. If disabled and lost a limb or a few limbs, and I wanted to get to a world that's more functional out there when you have more limbs, I probably would vote for the more functional one as opposed to the more prettier, you know? But yeah. I don't know. What do you think about that in terms of design? It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. The design iteration process is so fascinating. You know, what this immediately brought to mind was the whole skeuomorphic design conversation that we used to have a lot about on iOS when they were transitioning to sort of modern app design. So for instance, it used to be like you're coming from the culture of like, let's say a notepad, right? Or like an Evernote, right? You would have a notebook. So the icon would be this notebook with like a spiral, you know, thing on the side, and you'd be opening the page like this, and you'd have this effect of a page flipping, and you would be typing in between the ruled lines of a notepad tradition. And that's sort of how it all, a lot of applications like that started, because that was your reference, right? That was your real life reference, was like a notebook, a traditional one. But what a lot of people found, as we see in things like, you know, like Evernote now or other note taking apps of your choice, is you don't need any of that nonsense, you know, any of that real life type of page turning effect or anything like that. And that's kind of a funny example, but they call that skeuomorphic design, right? Of going from that to this, you learn those type of things like, hey, this is much more easy. We don't need this goofy transitions or anything like that. So obviously that would translate to physical design as well. When you see, like you were mentioning, the runners with the antelope legs, for lack of a better word, I believe that's what a lot of people called them. You saw them at first, you're like, whoa, that's really weird. But then you see how they perform, and you're like, wow, I can see that, how that's really advantageous compared to like the normal design of a human leg, you know? All right, so thanks to Davies Media Design for this one. GIMP is quietly working on its own version of smart objects, and it's just as good as Photoshop's. So this one's from Michael Davies. I'd like to thank him for this one. If you guys don't know, GIMP is like an open source free Photoshop alternative. I highly recommend you go check it out if you want to save a few, you know, hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars. So GIMP quietly announced via retweet that the Zarmot team was working on a new feature they are calling the Linked Layers feature. Note this has nothing to do with the Transform Link feature already found in GIMP. In fact, working for this feature actually began in 2019, but due to limited developers working on GIMP, this feature was shelved until recently. Jehan from Zarmot, who recently revisited development on this feature, described the application of Linked Layers in this way. What if you wanted to use the same background on several images? Instead of duplicating it, you could just link it from all images using it. And if you edit a bit of your common background, it would automatically update the render of all images. Sound familiar? To me, this sounds like GIMP's version of Smart Objects, the popular Photoshop feature that allows you to link a different file to your composition. Then you have that file live update in your current composition anytime you make changes to it. This has many applications, especially in the world of creating universal templates that can be updated with your own design. By simply replacing a linked image with your own design, then resaving that image, this is huge. Almost like a tip there for tip time, go download GIMP. I would say it's free. It's a great Photoshop alternative. And this is a really big announcement by GIMP, and I look forward to its implementation. It's going to be huge.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
That's awesome. Okay, pandemic gets Japan's automated delivery services on the road. So thanks to Japan Today, Japan is paving the way for autonomous delivery robots to become part of everyday life, with social distancing efforts requiring during a coronavirus pandemic making the push all the more vital. You know, we talked about this, right? The coronavirus has increased the appeal of services that allow for reduced human contact, and Japanese firms are counting on the potential of robots that can, if not in the distant future, deliver a range of products from nearby warehouses, shops to consumers. So it's so interesting with Japanese design. You know, they made these these autonomous robot cars look like, you know, the best thing I could kind of tell us is like Thomas the Steam Engine type
thing. Oh, yeah. Thomas the Train.
Thomas the Train, sorry. They made it really cute, as they always do, right? So, but it's interesting. I guess they're really trying to get this in Tokyo, which is a very dense population, and it's supposed to be really kind of, you know, they're going to try it with one, not the main train station, but something near there with cashless payments and all this stuff, and within a designated area around the train station and shops there. So I'm kind of excited about how that's going to go. But, you know, I think Rakuten, one of the e-commerce giants, you know, like the Amazon of Japan, they're going to also carry out a demonstration of delivery service on an autonomous vehicle by the end of this year. So, I mean, this pandemic is really, as we've talked about many times, has been pushing the envelope for some of these automated services.
Speed round.
Speed round. Right. Speed round.
Yeah. Thanks to CNBC's D.T. Roy for this particular story. San Francisco apartment rent prices are dropping fast as tech companies embrace remote work and unemployment rises. So the key points of this article is that the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco fell 11.8% year-over-year in June, following a 9% year-over-year drop in May. Tech companies like Twitter and Facebook are embracing remote work on a long-term basis, leading some tech workers to just leave the city, as they will no longer need to commute to an office. Rising, and then the third point is rising unemployment, of course, right? Thanks to the coronavirus pandemic and lockdown may also definitely is a factor. So new monthly data from apartment rental platform Zumper shows that San Francisco rents were down nearly 12% year over year in June, as we mentioned, making the city's decline the largest in the nation and a record slide for San Francisco. It's also the second consecutive month that San Francisco rental prices have dropped, right? Says the company, which was based these statistics on 9,000 listings in San Francisco. According to Zumper, the median rental price for a one-bedroom apartment in San Francisco fell 11.8% year over year from $3,720 to $3,280, beating May 9th's 9% drop. The survey also reports a 1% uptick in national rents, with the average median apartment in the U.S. renting for $1,229 in June. What they're showing is that the cities essentially are sort of on a downward trajectory and the suburbs are staying strong. But again, this depends on the region. I know Sacramento has actually seen an uptick because a lot of people are leaving for Sacramento as well here in California. So another quote, if rents continue to decline in the city, says a landlord, we could also see some landlords opting to sell and would-be buyers deciding to continue renting, says Bakari, who also notes the inventory of homes for sale in San Francisco is up 18% year over year. Quote, the jump in inventory in San Francisco may indicate less desire for homes in the expensive urban center as buyers envision a permanent shift towards remote work and seek out larger homes and affordability further from the city, says Bakari. Zumper also notes that rental prices in markets just outside of major metropolitan areas are up. So like what I mentioned, some examples include Providence, Rhode Island, and Sacramento, California, where prices are up about 5%. In another sign that tech workers are fleeing the city, the San Francisco Apartment Association, which conducted a survey of nearly 300 landlords who own more than 10,000 apartments, or about 6% of the city's total rental units, reports nearly 7.5% of respondents decided not to renew their leases over the last 3 months. While the SFAA doesn't have figures from last year, officials with the organization says the increase is shockingly high. Anecdotally, we've been hearing from members that lots of their renters were turning in their keys and leaving, says Charlie Ghost, the association's policies director. Quote, some residents are leaving the city altogether, but some are deciding to leave behind their roommate situations or are seeking more space.
You know, you could get your DeLorean on the air now. Flying cars are illegal, says newly passed New Hampshire law. Thanks to interesting engineering for this. New Hampshire has passed a new bill making flying cars legal, although no one could buy one. It seems the libertarian reputation, as the article says, of New Hampshire is well deserved, as the state just passed a law legalizing flying cars on railroads. Little thought seems to be allotted to affordability, futurism reports. There was nothing on the books that would allow this type of vehicle on the road, says Packard, who is a one of the bill sponsors of the state house, to an HPR. To allow them to even exist in New Hampshire, we had to pass this type of legislation. However, the law won't let anyone fly just a car into the skies above the roads of New Hampshire, reports CNET, who pointed out another intriguing technical drawback. No one could actually buy a flying car yet, despite a growing number of startups and larger firms who've announced their aim to build one. But I thought about this. I mean, I see all these like solo vehicles, like, you know, these helicopters and stuff like that. So right. I guess that would probably qualify, I would think, in this. But they're claiming that flying cars won't distract traditional traffic. I'm still trying to put my head around that one. But okay, yeah, I guess until the air gets too crowded, which, you know, that's another thing. But.
So, yeah, Greg, so you got an update. I already mentioned GIMP. I guess that's the tip. You guys go download GIMP, G-I-M-P, at GIMP.org, GIMP.org. But let's talk about, you know, some things that we've been talking about previously past couple of weeks was this NAS update.
Oh, yeah. So NAS is a network-attached server, and I do a lot of video work. And I realized that I was storing them on these external drives, and that's dangerous. I found out.
Yeah.
And I also learned, I said, okay, maybe I just need to go to a RAID system, but I also learned there's a risk of RAID because there's still any infection that goes in one drive will also corrupt the other drive.
Really?
So that's something I learned with the RAID. So what I decided to do, and I'll document this for you guys and, you know, probably do a video and try to do an article on this. I started to look into these things called thin client servers, and HP makes some really cool ones, called, you know, HP 620, 520, 630, 730, whatever. But right. Basically, these are AMD-generated quad-core, dual-core processors, and they're probably just perfect for a attached USB bank of drives. And so what I did this week is that I bought one, and I also bought a used VidaSonic 4-bay SATA server, a SATA bank. And so I bought like 3 6-terabyte drives, and I think I'm going to put maybe a 10 terabyte in the last one. And I'm just going to back that up, I'm thinking, with Backblaze automatically. The idea here is that I'll have cloud backup with my physical backup in case my, the house burns or whatever.
Of course,
but Backblaze will just automatically, you know, whenever it has time. I've heard a lot of latency and stuff like that, but as long as I have a cloud backup in a week, probably my risk is fairly low. But anyway, I'm starting to learn and document all this. Unfortunately, it's Windows 10. I'm a Mac guy, so I had a big learning curve of how to clone a Windows 10 thing. Because, like, generally, when you upgrade your hard drive to a bigger hard drive on Mac, you just go to Time Machine, and then you could just clone it back onto that bigger drive on Clone Machine, and then swap out the drive. That's what I learned upgrading my 2013 MacBook Pro, 13-inch. So with Windows, it's a little bit more difficult, but it's still doable, and they have software that does it. So, but anyway, that's the latest update. I'll try to show you some pictures and kind of share some of wisdom with you guys, and that's how I did it. So the computer with Windows 10 installed on it was $54.
Wow.
And I just had to upgrade the hard drive a little bit just to have a little bit more space on this. But it already came with a 16 gigabyte SSD and 4 gig memory. It's probably good for a NAS. At that point, I might go to 8 just to give it a little bit more room if I want to.
That's amazing. So you're saving hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, the most expensive part are the drives. And I found out the sweet spot for drives are $20 per terabyte. If you get anything below $20 per terabyte, you're doing good. You know, you're not going to get it any better than that. But if you get it below $20 a terabyte, go for it. So 6, 8, whatever. So that's my wisdom. I'll try to share it on a real thing with you guys. And I'm collecting videos that have helped me through this journey so far. So
nice. Anyway, and listeners, watchers, if you have any tips for Greg in terms of this too, please pass it our way. If you guys know something we don't.
Please.
Thanks for watching and listening to NerdStalker. I am Adolfo Fronda at NerdStalker on Twitter. You can reach me at adolfo@nerdstalker.com. Check us out at nerdstalker.com, NerdStalker TV on YouTube. Give us a like, subscribe, hit the bell, and we would really appreciate it. Greg, where can we get more information about you?
Oh, email me on socialgreg@nerdstalker.com. And also you could reach me if you want at socialgreg on Twitter. And again, support the Patreon channel for NerdStalker. Support all that stuff because we want to do more things like this for you guys. So anyway.
All right, you guys. See you guys next week.
All right. Be careful out there.
All right. Yeah.